Another busy day and way too much to talk about on Political Rewind today. We were going to try to steal the first hour from All Things Considered so we have time to talk about everything. But guess what? They don't want to give it to us. And I know you out there, like All Things Considered, you don't want to give it to us either. So we will do as much as we can over the next hour to talk about the big stories that are popping in news in Washington and here in Georgia. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is here, of course. His column is appears on Wednesdays and Sundays. Tell us what we're going to see on Sunday.
A Republican version of Medicaid expansion in Georgia.
A Republican version of Medicaid expansion.
Think opioid epidemic.
Oh, Renee Unterman is pushing this.
There we go.
State Senator Renee Unterman from Gwinnett County. That'll be interesting. Good, because she's starting to get a good amount of attention for what she's trying to do. So we'll look forward to that. You can also read Jim and his colleagues at the at Politically Georgia, the new political site that the AJC has put up. Michael Owens is here. He is the chairman of the Democratic Party of Cobb County. Thank you for being here, Michael.
As always, Bill, happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us. We won't ask you today, but one of these days we're going to ask you if your Twitter handle, the new one, means anything. It looks like you may be preparing to run for office, perhaps.
I'm just preparing to keep serving the people of Cobb County.
What's that handle?
Oh, my goodness.
What's that handle?
Anybody wants to follow me, you can follow me at Owens4GA13.
Oh, interesting.
On Twitter.
All right. Well, you're not there yet, so you're welcome to be with us, and we're always glad to have you. Loretta Lepore, who is a Republican strategist. She, as you've heard us say before, was co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign here in Georgia, but she also does a lot of government affairs work and has a particular expertise in transportation. And looks like you could have a big legislative session as people are moving more and more to thinking about transit in this state. Yeah?
Yes. I think the transit, obviously, study committee is not going to come back for another year.
Right.
So we're not going to see that. But at the local level,
yeah,
we are seeing a lot of municipalities, counties looking at expanding transit and potentially putting out referenda in the coming year.
Okay. Thank you for that. We'll talk. We'll get into that at some point down the line, not today. And we'll have you back to talk about it. And Connor Sen, who writes on financial matters for Bloomberg View, is back. We asked Connor to come back. He was with us on Wednesday, but now that the Republicans have in fact unveiled their tax reform plan, thank you for being back again today.
Thanks for having me again.
Is it a reform plan or is it a cut? I mean, there's been some, I mean, I know it's all just rhetoric, but there is a difference. One is a bigger, broader vision. The other is just change the tax structure.
I think if your taxes got cut, it's a cut. And if they went up, it's probably more reform.
Okay. Yeah. We'll get into that in just a minute. But we do have, again, today some breaking news. Just about an hour ago, the wire services moved this story. And it's curious, I think. The Trump administration released a dire scientific report Friday detailing the growing threat of climate change. The Washington Post version of this story points out the report stands in stark contrast to the administration's effort to downplay human role in global warming. And Jim, what's fascinating about it is this report says there is no question that it is human interaction with the climate that is causing warming.
Right, right, which contradicts Trump policy at this point. And as the Post article points out, it speaks to the resiliency of the federal scientific community or the deep state, depending on your point of view.
Yeah, this comes from the National Climate. It's a government agency, as you point out, the National Climate Assessment, and it is mandated. But Loretta, there was talk that the Trump administration would hold this sort of thing back because it contradicts everything they've been saying, but they let it come out.
Right. And I think now you're going to have to see some reconciling of messaging between what your political appointees are saying and what the scientific community within each of these agencies, as the report said, I believe it was the Washington Post, said that the scientists within several of the agencies had reviewed the report, participated in the report, and approved it. And so it'll be interesting to see what the implications are for some of the secretaries and how they navigate through this, as well as how the Trump administration presents at the Paris Accord meetings.
Yeah, I'm not actually holding my breath that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is suddenly going to jump on board and say, "Oh my gosh, I've been wrong all this time." Right?
No, but it creates a national talking point for the administration, for every secretary in the cabinet who has to be asked about this.
All right, let's we will have plenty of time to get into that down the road. But the big story in Washington, certainly this week, and even more so yesterday and today, is the fact that Republicans, Connor, have been working on their tax bill behind closed doors for quite some time now. Little hints here and there of what they think they want to do. I think put a few things out there to get a sense of how people might respond, but a lot of what they had talked about has actually ended up in this bill. Let me take just a moment to summarize it briefly. They've talked about consolidating tax brackets, and they have, in fact, the plan does do that. It goes from 7 to 4. With rates of 12, 25, 35, and 39.6, almost 40%. Before we go any further, what's the significance of reducing to 4?
I think it's really more optics than anything else. For the most part, if you've got tax software or an accountant does your stuff, it's just a calculation and a spreadsheet. So that part isn't that big of a deal, outside of just it sounds good.
And that's individual taxes, of course, we're talking about now, right?
Right, exactly.
I think it's the thing that stands out to me is the way this goes after higher education.
Yeah, we're going to get in. Yes, and I want to get into that. Let me just though go through a couple of things, and we'll come to higher education. So the first thing that I think is going to cause clearly some real problems up on the Hill in trying to pass this thing are. They have gone ahead with a very controversial plan to eliminate the deduction for state and local taxes. Loretta, why has that been so controversial?
Well, because there are some, generally, taxes are higher in some of the blue states. But even in those blue states, it's Republicans that represent. And so there are some moderate Republicans that are going to have some challenges in figuring out how they're going to come down on this legislation and this piece in particular.
Yeah, how do they go back to their constituent? We've already seen some members from New York, New Jersey, who are saying, as things stand right now, we're not supporting this thing. We can't take this back to our constituents and sell them on it, right?
Right, but in part of those communities, you have the very richest people actually do better from this because of the big corporate tax cut and the estate tax cut. So even if the sort of rank and file, moderately wealthy person, it might be Republican and maybe worse off from this, the super wealthy donor is actually better off. And maybe they're playing more to the donors than the voters.
Michael, this does, though, seem like a territory that Democrats can exploit.
Yeah, I think, when I was looking at this, amongst the 490-something pages, 420 pages, what I really started to really look at was with the corporate tax stuff, right? And the idea that I think this goes along into Trump's story as well. But when you're talking about cutting these taxes down for corporate taxes, really to keep more of this money in the country, or the fact that these vast millions that corporations make in other countries, that they would then be willing to bring those funds back into this country at, I think, at like 12% now, which is a lower rate. But there's no actual guarantee that that would even happen, number one. And we're just going to wait and see on that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I would point to two opponents that have jumped up to this, and they're both Republican.
Yep.
The house building industry is one.
Yep.
They're not happy with the lid that's been put on mortgage interest.
Yep.
At $500,000.
No higher than $500,000.
And totally eliminated for second homes.
Yes.
And this is the more interesting one. I think the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is a very, very conservative group. And I think the pass-through tax Is there bête noire there?
Yeah.
Well, they're going to want to make sure that all small businesses get some tax break, and that not some are getting a break, or while others are going to be harmed under this. So you're looking at LLCs, S corps, and some corporations that are passing through.
A lot of small services businesses.
Right. Professional services firms, in particular, are in question as to whether they will benefit or not. It really depends on what their income is. And what their personal income is, too, because those taxes are passed through onto their business taxes are passed through onto their personal taxes.
All right. So let me pause for a moment and then get you all into this conversation in a very general way. I think it's safe to say that you could pick up the Wall Street Journal. You could pick up Breitbart. You could pick up any number of more conservative-leaning publications. Well, and I don't mean to put the Journal in the same league as Breitbart. Nevertheless, they each tend to be more supportive of conservative causes. And maybe I should throw them out of the mix. You're going to see completely different interpretations of what this bill does. Is it good for the middle class or not? Is it, in fact, favoring the wealthy? And I'm not sure that right now, it's not going to live in its current form, and it's hard to get a really strong handle right now, I think it's fair to say, on which interpretation is correct. Am I right about that?
I think it speaks to the fact that Republicans are somewhat divided on taxes right now. And so you still have this old guard 1980s coalition just looking to cut corporate taxes because that's what they believe is the best thing to do. You have the sort of, to Loretta's point, these New York, New Jersey, California Republicans who feel like they're getting hit by the end of the state and local income tax deduction. And then you have senators in Republican senators like Mike Lee and Marco Rubio, who are very family focused and really want to see much more of a middle class, child based tax policy. And they haven't seen that yet.
Anybody want to jump in on that?
I think one of the issues here is this may be one of the last opportunities for Trump to actually get anything done, any kind of substantial legislation passed before these next midterm elections come up, right? So, you know, but the thing I really don't like is, you know, this is being done in almost absolute secrecy now, right? And so with very little time to kind of figure out what's in there on both sides, right? Whether to figure out what's good, what's bad, to have other people kind of comment on it, other members of the House. So, you know, the idea of doing this in secrecy really, really puts a lot of pressure, I think, on some of those other caucuses, the Freedom Caucus and some of those others, to really evaluate this and decide which side do they want to get on.
Well, I would take issue with that in particular because there is going to be a revised version of this bill probably put forward by Monday. The chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee has already indicated that, where they're going to clean up some of these things, and they are getting input from some members in their caucus. The other thing is that this will be a very transparent process because the committee will hold hearings on this. And then you're going to have the Senate start weighing in with their version of the bill. And we've already seen some members come forward, like Marco Rubio, calling for an increase in the child tax credit, right? He's been working with Ivanka Trump, which this is her pet issue. She had wanted it to be at $2,500. It came in at $1,600, which is more, $600 more than it currently is. And so he's going to advocate for that in the Senate. So I do think you're going to see much more of a public process in this, a public vetting of this particular bill. But while it is important to the president, I think tax reform is vitally important to the members of Congress, in particular, the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. He has been working the majority of his career has been spent working toward this goal of getting a tax reform package on the table.
As long as you mention him, here's a very brief sound from Paul Ryan yesterday talking to reporters.
We're going to get this done because we told the American people this is what we're going to do if we get this majority. And guess what? We're doing it.
There he is. We're doing it, Loretta.
Exactly.
But under your scenario, and throw this out to anybody, are we going to see the same thing here that we saw with repeal and replace? House spends all this time agonizing over getting a bill that their members can support. It goes to the Senate, and the Senate throws it out and starts all over again.
No, I don't think so. I think you're going to see somebody build upon this.
Okay.
And the other thing I would point out is in particularly in Georgia, you have a tendency for half the Republican delegation in the House to wander away saying, oh, we want more, we want more, we want bigger cuts, we want more. I don't think that's going to happen, because Georgia just got this $800 million tax credit guarantee for the continuation of the construction of Plant Vogtle, and that means each of those votes are now committed to that.
Right.
Yeah, and I think you have 10. I think 10 members of Congress. I think there were only two that were not on board.
Yeah, just Hank right? Johnson and John Lewis. Everybody yeah. else signed on.
Signed on to the tax break.
I'm sorry. And also the repeal and replace. That was done under reconciliation. There were different rules garnering that discussion. And I think with this tax plan, there is potential to draw over some moderate Democrats to support this bill.
It's still reconciliation.
Wait, okay, I apologize.
That's right. There's no question that the Republicans would love to bring some Democrats over on this thing, right?
Republicans would, but since President Trump has made no outreach to them, it's going to be a tough sell.
Connor, okay, tell me how, and Loretta, you too, how are Republicans explaining the $1.5 trillion increase in the deficit?
Well, I've heard Mick Mulvaney, the OMB chair, the OMB director, talk about this. And what he speaks to is, right, he was a fiscal hawk when he was in Congress.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets called on that all the time. And he's done the morning news circuit. And I suspect he'll be doing it again this weekend.
And we'll hear about the Laffer curve.
But his point is that what they're striving for is an increase in growth. That this will stimulate growth and that growth will improve from this stagnant sort of 1.5, 2% growth rate for the country to potentially upwards of 3%.
All right. In fact, that's one of the talking points that's being circulated. And Georgia's Congressman Buddy Carter talked about it on MSNBC today, and he made very much the same point. Let's listen.
What we've got to do is to grow our economy. This will help us to grow our economy. If we are ever going to address our national debt, we've got to do three things. We've got to cut spending, we've got to have entitlement reform, and we've got to grow our way out of it.
Right, so
when you cut corporate tax rates, when you cut it from 35 down to 20%, that's going to be money in people's pockets.
Connor, is this magical thinking? We've heard this from Republicans for decades.
I think they believe in all those things, but it's when they're in the majority, they believe in growth, and when they're in the minority, they believe in deficits and entitlement reform.
All right, but to the point, can you, if you lower the corporate tax rate to 20%, even though I think I'm correct that a great many corporations in this country don't even pay 20%, so in some ways there's a symbolism behind that number two, isn't there?
Right. A lot of multinational corporations get a lot of their income from abroad, like big tech and pharma companies in particular, and they're already paying 20% or less. This doesn't really do a whole lot for them. It's really, there is some optics to this as well, where, you know, actually retail firms do pay a high tax rate, so it probably is beneficial for them.
All right. Is there sound economic thinking behind the notion that lowering the corporate tax rate, in fact, increases jobs, it brings more money in? How real is this?
Well, I think we've heard folks talk about this on both sides of the aisle for a long time. I will go back to our U.S. Senate race, where both Michelle Nunn and David Perdue supported corporate repatriation of tax dollars. And the thinking being that it's the jobs that are coming back, dollars that are being put overseas, and jobs that are being put overseas will be brought back to this country if they're not taxed on that income coming back into the U.S. So if you could look at a case like Ireland, who has a new leadership over there, he's touting the fact that he has a number of U.S. technology companies, biotech companies that are doing business there because their tax rate is much lower than it is here.
And yeah, Republicans and economists agree that corporate tax rates across the world are at different levels right now, and the U.S. is on the high side. And so by lowering it, we at least become more competitive to other countries. The issue is just how do we offset that deficit that creates?
You know, one of the issues here is that I think Connor made the statement about U.S. global multinational corporations. So many of these companies that we have even here in Atlanta, as a matter of fact, make the vast majority of their revenue overseas in other countries, right? So, you know, the idea that we can operate in this no longer of a global society, right? We can go back to some kind of idea of a role of protectionism, right? Where we can really pull back and make sure this jobs first, all American. That's not exactly the way this world works anymore, where, you know, you have a company like Coca-Cola who sells most of those soft drinks in other countries.
All right.
Well, I was going to say, it's just like economic development is not just a state-by-state competitive race anymore. This is a country-by-country competition.
Okay. I want to get one more thing out of the way here, because I think it's important, and then we want to move on. Jim, you referred to higher education and some some of the hits it takes. So let me set it up this way. There is no question that this bill, if you do not itemize, if you just do your standard return, it appears this bill is going to be beneficial. It increases the standard deduction for individuals. It doubles it from $6,300 to $12,000. And for families, it increases it from $12,700 to $24,000. So if you standard deduction, that's great. But as you point out, Jim, you're no longer going to be able to deduct interest on a college loan, for example. That seems to me, if you're doing itemization, the college loans are already killing people in this country. This seems like an odd thing to choose.
That would be the epitome of a middle tax, middle class issue, right? Yes. There. But then you also have the larger liberal arts colleges getting slapped beyond that, universities too, because the profits that their foundations make on investments are going to be taxed 1.9%, I think, which Emory University knows all about this already.
And to Jim's point, one sort of secret immigration part of this is you're waiving the tax deductibility of sort of waived tuition for grad students. And so if you're an international grad student at Columbia University in New York, and maybe you get free tuition because you do other work for the school, all of a sudden you're being taxed on that waived income, so you can maybe fewer Indians and Chinese come here to study.
Yeah, it does seem to me that if you do itemize your returns, that there are a number of these things that really are not beneficial to people, say, in that $70,000 to $100,000 range, yeah?
And let's remember college football.
What does that mean?
College football gets it in the
They're net. No longer going to be able. They're no longer going to be treated as nonprofits who can deduct.
Well. What right now, it, with many organizations, including University of Georgia, you have to give donations to the athletic association,
right,
in order to get in line to buy,
right,
a ticket.
Right.
Those initial gifts are not going to be tax deductible.
So I want to go back to this point about the deductions and the standard deductions, because in an earlier analysis of a tax plan by the Tax Policy Center, when they asked people, 84% of filers who currently itemize their deductions said they would take a standard deduction if it were doubled. If 84% of taxpayers take a standard deduction, yes, they can get down to a single card for filing, and it will outweigh. They don't have to itemize anymore, and the thinking here is that the benefit to the middle, lower income individuals is that they are going to get a benefit through a standard deduction than itemizing, which they don't do anyway.
I got to give you, that's the last word on this segment. I continue to be troubled because I think it's going to be it's a Rorschach test, and we'll watch how it unfolds. Everybody's going to have a different sense of what this really does, and we'll watch it and certainly have plenty of time to talk about it as we move forward. Look, I held off getting this break in, but I've got to do it right now. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, a major contributor to the economic and cultural vitality of downtown Atlanta and the metro Atlanta area.
I just got an email from one of our listeners saying, do a second hour for online listening. thank you for sending us that little email. With us today, Connor Sen from Bloomberg View, Loretta Lepore, Michael Owens, and Jim Galloway. We spend an awful lot of time on this show talking about how President Trump has, in fact, kind of thrown the Republican Party into a certain tizzy about where they're headed. But Jim, we have a big story this week, basically broke yesterday, that's going to cause, it's a bombshell planted in the middle of the Democratic Party. Donna Brazile, acting chair of the party, longtime Democratic soldier and leader. She ran Al Gore's campaign in 2000, one of the most visible and prominent Democratic leaders out there. And she has got a book coming out. Politico had a little piece of it yesterday. She contends that Hillary Clinton's campaign basically did in fact fix the nomination for Hillary Clinton, and did it to a large extent by taking control of the financial apparatus of the party and funneling it all back to her benefit.
Yeah, there was a 2015 agreement that they would have a call, they would have the call on leadership positions and certain policy positions. And you know, it, I don't know how widespread this was known. I'm thinking that a small circle of Democrats did indeed know this.
Well, she claims that when she took over as chair, that she had no idea, and she'd been on the board, the ruling board, the governing board, and says that no one knew about this. She finally got to the bottom of it, talking to the Clinton folks, and what they were doing, Loretta, is essentially saying, we're going to so the setup is President Obama didn't do a whole lot to help the Democratic Party raise money and, in fact, spent a lot of that money. So when he left office, they had terrible, terrible debt. And the Clinton campaign came to the rescue and said, we will offer you some, we will help you pay off your debts. They gave him a couple $1 million a month, I think is the figure. And did that, but seized the party apparatus. And in fact, some of the money they got came back, accrued to their benefit in the campaign as well, right?
That's absolutely right. And I mean, I think anecdotally that most people, Bernie Sanders included, thought that that things were rigged and that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was not being balanced in how she was supporting both candidates during that race. And now Donna Brazile's point is that now we have proof points that she, in fact, was not, that she, too, was, you know, on Team Clinton. And, you know, at the end of the day, though, you have to say, OK, well, Donna Brazile was complicit, at least through the election, as was Bernie Sanders, who went out and championed Hillary Clinton. So it's a big party issue. And, you know, there's a lot of house cleaning that's going to have to take place there. And this week, the DNC announced that they fired their fundraiser.
Yeah,
they've only raised a fraction of what Republicans have raised in the same amount of time.
All right, so Michael, I saved you for to get the next word in on this. How do you go back to your donors, your supporters in Cobb County, and explain this to them?
Well, what I do is what I've done all along, and I say that if you want to help elect Democrats in Cobb County, you donate your funds to the Cobb County Democrat Committee. that is what you do, right? Because we at a county party level are not funded by the DNC or the Democratic Party of Georgia. So that's a pretty easy answer right there. But you know, part of this, when I read it, obviously it was disheartening, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who are like, yeah, I told you so. But there's another part of me that went, wait a minute, this isn't new information.
Yeah, you're right? Saying it was already baked into
this
the cake.
This was the DNC announced in September of 2015 that they had reached a strategic agreement with the Clinton campaign for the Hillary Victory
Yes,
Fund.
Yes, but here's the difference. Typically, sure, once Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee, this is a fairly standard agreement once you're the nominee. But this began while she was still competing against Bernie Sanders.
I said October 2015.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right? I apologize.
In October 2016, the Politico also reported that there was some shenanigans going on. So if you go look at it, it was actually reported then, too, about some of those details that started coming up about the fact that DNC was really strapped for cash.
Okay, so but what does this do, in your opinion, to the unanimity of the party, which is shaky at best anyway, and what does it do to the spirit of Democrats as they face big, big off-year elections next year?
Yeah, it hurts, right? It continues to hurt. There's no other way around it. You take this and then you couple it with a couple of weeks ago with the new executive committee appointments from Chairman Tom Perez, and it just continues this theme, right? And unfortunately, it continues to fracture our party when we need to be, you know, more united than ever before.
Okay, but here's my question on this is that, okay, so Donna Brazile is wanting to make amends with the Bernie Sanders wing. She comes out with this information in November 2017. I'm guessing that book took at least 6 months to write, maybe 8 months. And in that meantime, we had an election in Atlanta for DNC chair between Tom Perez and Keith Ellison.
Yeah.
And if that information had been out then, maybe we would have had a different result.
You know, it's interesting you point that out because, of course, Donna Brazile presided over the whole conference until the election of the new chair. So she was at the podium. She was deeply involved in all this. And you're right. None of this came to light at all, which does make you wonder exactly what's going on with all of that as well. All right. That story is going to continue. But let's move on. You know, it's really the Bob Mueller story continues, the indictments of Manafort, but mostly this Papadopoulos plea deal has really seized the imagination of a lot of people in Washington and around the country. We have confirmation from a party, somebody who's involved with the Trump campaign, who sat in on the meeting that was attended by Papadopoulos, Sessions, and Trump, in which Papadopoulos apparently tried, maybe in his youthful excitement, to get the Trump campaign to meet with the Russian officials he claimed to know. The White House has denied that ever happened, but we now find that someone has emerged who says, oh, I was in that meeting. It did happen. Jeff Sessions was there. And so it calls into question this kind of exchange that Sessions had when he was on the Hill testifying when he was nominated for his AG position.
I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign.
You don't believe that surrogates from the Trump campaign had communications with the Russians. Is that what you're saying?
I did not, and I'm not aware of anyone else that did.
So that seems just to be out and out contradicted by what we're learning about this March meeting.
This was the statement that you just heard from Sessions was said in kind of in light of that June meeting with Donald Trump Jr. At Trump Tower. Now we have this one, and this one puts Jeff Sessions. There's a photo. The photo from the March 21st meeting shows Jeff Sessions right there.
Yeah, Connor, so we've now got we got enough problems on the Hill with trying to get a tax bill through. This now hangs over everything and creates even more disruptions and distractions.
Sure, I think we've got kind of an imbalance between the amount of controversy going on and the amount of oxygen we have to deal with it. And right now the oxygen is on the tax bill and not Mueller, but by Monday that could change.
Loretta?
I think, yes, that it does hang as a cloud. It's been hanging as a cloud over the entire administration. You know, since the president was sworn into office, this has kind of been hanging out there. And I understand that, you know, from reporting that he's wondering when this is all going to come to an end, too. He's verbally articulated that. How far is this going to go? I think with regard to Attorney General Sessions, you know, some of his starkest critics are his former colleagues. And in the Senate. And I think that, you know, he faces some really severe ramifications if he gets called before the Congress again to testify on these conversations.
All right. So Democrats certainly are calling for him to return to the Hill. I have not yet heard any Republican leader saying they think Sessions better get back up there and testify again, right? Everybody's shaking their heads. We have not heard that from anyone. Sessions, by the way, insists that he has not been called by Mueller to be interviewed, to give testimony, whatever. You've got to wonder, though, if now it's inevitable. Well, it may have been inevitable anyway. They were just waiting.
Staying, not getting a phone call from Bob Mueller may not be such a good thing.
Yeah, maybe. Right. That's exactly right.
Exactly. If what the legal analysts say about Papadopoulos being wired for a certain amount of time, Mueller may have what he needs. Yeah. You know, so who's to say?
Michael Trump has been tweeting about this, trying to call attention has been trying to distract attention from this by tweeting again, going back to Donna Brazile and the dishonesty of the Clinton campaign, as he would call it. But he's not going to take attention away.
This is a perfect example of what he has done fairly well, right? Which is deflect, which is to, you know, let's cause another distraction if we can. But this whole idea that, you know, Papadopoulos was nothing more than a water boy, and no one remembers what he said, and he had no, you know, reason to even be in the room, but he was at the table.
Yeah,
and
Jim
said, there's pictures there.
Okay, so I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, by the way. Loretta, you've operated in campaigns for a long time. There really are these eager young campaign volunteers, and apparently he was that, who find a way to into a circle like he was in. That's a pretty high circle, I give you that. Nevertheless, they apparently, Sessions apparently quickly said, we're not meeting with the Russians. But that's different than denying that anybody ever suggested it in the first place. And it doesn't matter whether he was just a coffee boy or not. It happened.
Right. He did have unprecedented access. And while most campaigns do have younger staffers around, they're usually not considered chief foreign policy advisors, you know. So, you know, I think that he was an earnest young man who got in over his head and perhaps did put ideas out on the table, and whether these other more senior, veteran, seasoned, mature, whatever you want to call them, advisors to the president were, maybe have just, you know, they can say now we were just giving him a pat on the head, you know, thanking him for bringing forward what he wants. But this is serious. And so the optics and what the proof points are putting forward are not in alignment.
You know, unfortunately, every time this has came up, it's been, oh, well, that didn't happen. We don't recall this. You know, there was no interest in it. But every time we see any documentation or any proof, it's like, yeah, let us know more. Yeah, we're interested. You know, can we follow up with another meeting? I mean, the lady who was supposedly, you know, a Russian, had Russian information, that attorney, you know, it was the same thing. It's like, we don't know anything about it. And then we continue to find out there's more and more. We didn't know anything about it until there was a picture, right? Now, he's a senior foreign policy analyst who says something about Russia, but no one around the table remembers him saying that. I think everyone would remember that.
The other part of this to remember is that in the spring of 2016, Donald Trump was struggling to show anybody that he had decent foreign policy advisors in his camp.
That's right. Sure. He had to throw this group together
and
quickly.
And this young fellow Papadopoulos was originally advising Ben Carson.
Mm-hmm.
So the bar was pretty low.
All right. Let's get another break out of the way. When we come back, let's get into some state and local politics. There's a number of things happening, including a big race for mayor of Atlanta. But you're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Undocumented immigrants in southern Texas face a daily dilemma.
People who live here in Laredo are really living in an island. You can't go anywhere north, south, east, west without passing through some kind of checkpoint.
What that means for a woman who needs to see a doctor 150 miles away, plus more reaction to the Republican tax plan this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in this afternoon, 4 till 7 on GPB.
Jim Galloway, your newspaper, the AJC, had a really good summary of what's happening in some of the special legislative elections that are being held next week. And the theme is that whether they can win or not, there are a number of Democrats who are suddenly trying to be competitive in what have been relatively safe seats for Republicans.
Yeah. You have a lot of special elections, and that's what these are. These are all special elections, which means they're formally nonpartisan. And if there are multiple candidates, then the top two will go on into December. So it does give Democrats in certain areas a leg up. There's about, I think, six or seven state races involved. I would point you to Senate District 6, the Buckhead Senate seat that has eight candidates. And that's a very, very possible Democratic pickup, because you got to remember, Hunter Hill held that seat for 4 years.
Yes.
Not 4 years, but the occupant before that was Doug Stoner, who was a Democrat.
A Democrat, Hunter Hill, a Republican who gave up the seat because, of course, he's a Republican candidate for governor. Now, we don't know that any of these seats are going to end up being competitive next week, Loretta, but Democrats are ready to try to get back in the mix at the Capitol.
I think they are. I don't know that they're well positioned this go around, but I think there are incrementally they're putting more candidates forward for races. So, you know, Jaha Howard, to Jim's point, in Senate District 6, you know, he came very close to Hunter Hill in the last go-around, could have potentially unseated Hunter at that time. It is a more moderate Republican district, and there are pockets of Democrats, of heavy, hardcore Democrats in that district. So it's a challenging district for Republicans to hold on to. But I don't see them taking seats that they don't have already, at least not many of them.
All right. I think turnout's a big factor since it's a off year. You know, it's who's going to show up? Are you going to show up to vote in Forsyth County in November of 2017? We'll have to see.
Yeah. Michael?
You know, I'm getting reports, obviously, of low voter turnout. You know, and as Connor said, you know, anytime you're talking about special elections, it's all about turnout, right? Can you motivate people to get out and vote? So the early voting numbers thus far have not been fantastic. Didn't have great weather last Saturday, so that kind of depressed it down.
Yeah, and this is true for both Democrats and Republicans. This doesn't reflect any partisan energy one way or the other.
That's been
true in the Atlanta mayor's race as well. All right, let's go on to another interesting state story. We talked about it the other day when it first came to light. I still don't know quite what to make of it, Jim Galloway. You're the expert. I'll ask you about it. So Georgia's attorney general has brought the attorney general's office has hired Democrat Roy Barnes to defend the secretary of state's office, Brian Kemp, in this suit about ballot integrity, election integrity with the breaches at the computer, election computer up at Kennesaw State. I still don't quite understand why they thought they couldn't take the case, the AG.
Okay.
Is it a simple matter of conflict of interest?
Okay, you've got multiple parties involved in this suit. A national kind of voting rights group on the outside making the charge against several state entities. KSU is one of them. Brian Kemp is another one. And the what happened was, remember we had that flap over the wiped server, which has now turned out to be pretty much nothing.
Right.
That Brian Kemp condemned it and said he was going to investigate it and get to the bottom. He did a little quick investigation, found out it's all okay. Everybody's got it. No data lost, no harm, no foul. But what you have is, of course, you had two state entities going at each other.
Mm-hmm. All
and
right.
And that sets up a situation where Brian Kemp's interests and KSU's interests are not
so
identical.
You do have to have an outside counsel.
Exactly.
But,
yes.
Michael, you hired Democrat Roy Barnes, who has had his issues over the years with Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp.
Yeah, no doubt. I have to wonder if some of this is just optics, right? Going, well, hey, if Governor Barnes is willing to take this on, then we can take some of the partisan stigma out of it, right? And from my purview, when I look at this as a whole, understanding, you know, the discussion about the wiped server, let alone the fact of what's happened with the Secretary of State's office with their protectorate of 6.7 million voters' information, right? That first and foremost, we have to get back to what we're talking about, right? And this is not the first time that voter information has leaked out, right? And we don't know the exact extent of it right now, but it's problematic.
Two things. Number one, Roy Barnes did represent Sonny Perdue in
yes.
a matter a couple of years back,
yes.
so this is not unprecedented.
Right.
And there's a little triangulation here going on. Brian Kemp has picked a lot of fights with Stacey Abrams, one of the two Democratic candidates for governor. Barnes is backing Stacey Evans, the other one. The other candidate in the Democratic race for governor.
All right. It's going to be fun to watch that thing play out, that's for sure. I don't think we have a lot of time, unfortunately, to get into this. But, Loretta, let's talk at least briefly about the Atlanta mayor's race. We vote on Tuesday. I don't live in the city, so when I say we, I mean that sort of as a collective we. We now know that there's been like $10 million donated to the candidates in that race. The AJC this morning had a story talking about the fact that lobbyists who usually give to state campaigns and state incumbents and candidates suddenly seem to be getting deeply involved in the mayor's race. What's going on here?
Well, I think you've seen over the years, particularly with the relationship between Governor Deal and Mayor Reed, that the state and the city have benefited by the two of them working together. Right. So there are a lot of good things that have happened by them agreeing to work together that wasn't working before. We've gotten money for the ports that we otherwise might not have had. And there are many other occasions in which they've worked together to benefit the state and the city. So I think that there's I think that folks all around, whether it's lobbyists or whether it's business, see the benefits of that. And so it's important who sits in the mayor's office, particularly because the next year we have a governor's race, right? And I think that people would like to see that relationship be perpetuated. And they'd like to get behind the candidates that they think are gonna allow their business to move forward at both a city and state level.
Jim, you were pointing at Loretta like you hit it right on the head.
And that's what we before we went on air, you and I were talking about this.
You said exactly that. Is it getting some attention here, too, because of the contractor pay-for-play scandal unfolding at City Hall?
I don't think so. But what you're seeing is kind of a change in the dynamic, in the financial dynamic, because generally speaking, Atlanta mayoral races have been funded out of the airport concessions. Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing a broader financial interest expressed by lobbyists in the state capitol.
We are very skeptical about polling because it's such a small voter universe. But there are an awful lot of people who think this comes down to a runoff between Mary Norwood, who is calls herself an independent but has been tagged by Democrats as a Republican for years, and Keisha Lance Bottoms, the mayor's candidate. Speculation, folks?
I can't say anything. I can't give any details.
Oh, we got a poll coming.
I would just urge you to turn into WSB TV at 6 o'clock.
Oh, my God. All right. I guess we'll wait and see. That means that Mark Roundtree of Landmark Communications, who was here just last week, obviously has a final poll in this race. And if anybody's going to have an accurate poll, I think, Loretta, it would be Roundtree, who has proven time and time again he really knows how to get it right.
Well, I think there's anecdotal evidence out in the community too about who are the leaders in this race, right? So, I will say though that as a city resident, that I hear a lot from people who are there are so many candidates in all of the city races that voters cannot tell the difference. And
yeah.
I think, to Michael's point about the low voter turnout, people are saying, I got to sit down this weekend. I've got to look at these candidates. I've got to figure out who's who and who I'm going to vote for.
Yeah, Connor, I think that's a great point. Nobody has managed to break through the way that Trump did in a field of 18 last year.
I was talking to a city council candidate this morning. I won't say who, but he was saying that he hopes it goes to a runoff because then he'll actually have volunteers and oxygen to get his story out. And that's really a challenge for a lot of these candidates right now.
Yeah. And you're seeing some of this. I've taken a look, an OTP look, right outside the perimeter. And back to the point about the mayor's race in itself, and that, we're always wondering, we say about the mayor's race. We're not talking about the mayor of Acworth or the mayor of Kennesaw, right? You say the mayor's race, you're talking about the mayor of Atlanta, because I think we all realize that, the Atlanta as a economic engine, right, drives the entire state to some extent. So, the more important... The more we understand and line up who that next mayor is going to be, is literally to your point, right? It's going to help kind of dictate and drive as we move to the governor's race and that relationship to get built.
A couple of quick pickup items. President Trump, his Twitter feed went down for 11 minutes overnight, and apparently the world continued to revolve on its axis, Loretta.
It did. And the president, in his true form, came out to say that that's just an indicator of how powerful Twitter is a forum. And, I mean, he is right in that respect, that it is a powerful forum for him. I will say, however, that subsequently throughout the day, it's raised a lot of questions just in the common discourse about the ability of a staffer to be able to touch the President of the United States' Twitter feed.
Yeah.
Yet it was his personal, it was his personal feed, not the POTUS feed. But yet, what's going on in these tech companies that allows that to happen?
So I used to work for eBay way back in the day, and at a very similar stage in the company's growth. And, we just sort of had access to a lot of things that we probably shouldn't have had access to because we weren't dictating world policy. And I think a lot of these companies culturally are still in this mindset.
Loretta, though, I mean, we can sort of laugh about it. It was an employee who was in his or her last day
right.
and decided to pull the plug.
Well, on the listening to the news on the way in, I had heard a reporter who has been following, tracking this all day, and she had indicated that inside of Twitter, they are saying, you know, she had talked to some of the senior managers there, that after the election last November, they did do a tightening of who had access to those accounts, right? But so that raises even more questions. Was it a senior level individual who had access, or was it a low level person who got into that mix?
Okay, but here, but there is a serious side to this, and you basically alluded to it. The President of the United States uses his personal Twitter account to speak to the world and to deliver policy positions. If he, I get that this was internal, but it tells us something about the fragility and, as you say, the vulnerability of an account and the malicious mischief that could really create trouble.
We need to hear from
our
cybersecurity
expert. Yeah, we got to hear from you quickly because you're the man,
our
Michael.
Our cyber expert.
You know, I this is obviously problematic. The idea that, if you guys remember back when President Obama first had the BlackBerry, right, and had to be super controlled, and you know, that's part of what we're seeing happening now, right? The idea that this is a regular common account. And so my biggest fear is thinking, when this account gets spoofed and it causes a downturn in economic, you know, as an economic disaster, right? Stock market loses 200 points.
When does somebody a tweet that we're decided we're going to launch missiles at North Korea now?
The issue is, this is a clear inherent danger of him having a regular secure, unsecure account, just like you or I would have. If I was Twitter, I would be very, very nervous about this and implication now. We've never seen this before at this level for one person to have this kind of control on an unvetted account, basically.
And it would be very hard to boot him off now, I think, if you were Twitter.
It would be very hard. I mean, well, anybody who gets their account shut down, has there's a process they have to go through from a process standpoint.
Well, I think these social media companies are coming under such scrutiny about the role that they are playing in our society, and in particular, how they are governing internally information, right? News organizations for years and years and years, traditional news organizations have internal policies about what would potentially jeopardize the country.
Yes.
They have, these are things that they have taken into account. These social media companies do not have those. And it's not a partisan thing. Dianne Feinstein called them on the carpet.
Right.
This, she lowered the hammer on them.
Yes.
And so there has to be some broader discussion within our society, a national dialogue about their level of responsibility.
It started on the Hill, but we're really not sure that the social media companies get it yet.
I think the real question is, in a future presidential primary, if a really radical candidate is using Twitter, if there's pressure to shut the account down before this person becomes a serious threat.
All right. Well, that's it. We are completely out of time. Connor Senn, Loretta Lepore, Michael Owens, and Jim Galloway. I leave you with this. Collins Dictionary has declared that the word of the year is fake news. Two words. The two words of the year, fake news. And I don't think there's anybody here who would question that the President of the United States has put that word into the common vocabulary for better or for worse. Thank you all for being here today. It was a real pleasure to have you here. We'll be back on Monday. I'll be down in Savannah. I've been asked to come down. I'm going to talk to the Savannah Rotary Club. I'm looking forward to that. And I'll be doing the show out of Savannah. But Jim Galloway, you'll be holding the Fort Downey right here in Atlanta, thank goodness, with Brian Robinson and others who are going to be on the show.
Is this my Al Haig moment?
Yeah. I'm in charge here. Thank you all for being with us. If you're listening in real time, have a great weekend. See you Monday at 2:00.